One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. Kenneth Godfrey taught in the church educational system for 37 years. He and his wife Audrey recently finished a history of seminaries and institutes that we discussed at length in Legacy Episode 38. We're here today to discuss the life and service of Charles W. Penrose, British convert, apostle, and poet. Kenneth, welcome back to Legacy.
Thank you very much.
Will you tell us why you chose to research and write about Charles Penrose?
Well, it's kind of a roundabout story. I was asked to participate on a symposium at Brigham Young University on the Pearl of Great Price. And my topic was the history of intelligence in Latter-day Saint thought. As I began to research this topic, I discovered that Charles W. Penrose had said quite a bit about intelligence and its what it was and its influence in Latter-day Saint thought. And as I found that out, I also found out that his diaries were in the Utah State Historical Society library, not in the possession of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I went down to the Historical Society and began to look at his diaries. There are about 15 books of them that cover his life. Sometimes he didn't keep a diary, but sometimes he did. And because they had been given to the Utah Historical Society, they were open for research, even though he became a member of the First Presidency and kept a diary while he was a member of the First Presidency. This piqued my interest in him as an individual. And so one day I went to the Utah Historical Society and copied all of his diaries and brought them home. So I have them in my library. And as time went on, I would read more and more about him, collect more and more things. And finally, I wrote a manuscript for a biography of Charles Penrose. And that's how I got interested in the man.
Has anyone done a biography before?
No, there hasn't been a biography done on him. In fact, there are a number of very important early Latter-day Saints that need biographies done, including Orson F. Whitney and Charles Penrose, some men that made a difference in the church with their writing and their thought and their expertise, as well as their great missionary abilities. And I suppose you could pick almost any apostle, and he would be an important enough figure that he would be worth a biography if it would only sell. They would be interesting to people, but maybe not enough individuals are interested in biography.
So Charles Penrose was born in London, England, and was a convert. I just can imagine him speaking with his English accent when he got over here. A few weeks ago, we had a Brigham Young quote where he said that he enjoyed just strolling the streets of Salt Lake City and basically hearing the multicultural type atmosphere that was here. So tell us about the beginning of Charles Penrose.
Well, he was born in London in 1832. The church was only 2 years old when Brother Penrose entered the world. His father was a fairly wealthy individual. I don't mean really wealthy, but they were comfortable. He was in the tin business, and so they were able to send Charles to Sunday school at a young age, and he was kind of a child prodigy. He learned to read extremely early in his life, and his father used to take him down to the pub when he was 3 or 4 years old, and he would stand on one of the bar stools and read from the London newspaper to the delight of the patrons of these pubs, that this little boy could read and pronounce even these kind of long words. And so when he got a little bit older, they put him, he was advanced in Sunday school because of his learning. And so he has this really good memory and kind of an inclination for words. He was also, early in his life, a kind of a champion of the underdog. He tells the story of being in school, and a bully in the school took his pen and ran it into one of the other students' hand. And Charles chastised him for doing that. And the bully says, "I'll get you after school." And so after the school day had ended, they meet on the playground, and the bully slugs Charles, who is much smaller than he was, and Charles just got this determined look on his face and was sort of an absence of fear, and just like a whirlwind just tore into the bully and got a lucky hit and knocked him down, and the bully began to cry and ran home shamed, and Charles was the hero of the school for a little while. And so he had this sense of justice that people shouldn't push other people around. And more to my point is, he really was a good student all the way along. And on one occasion, when he got a little older, this is 1850, he was reading in library in London on one occasion and ran across a book about the American Indians. And in the book, there was a picture of Joseph Smith preaching to some Indians. And Charles was fascinated by that picture and by the little account that was there. And shortly after that experience, he met some Mormon missionaries on the streets, and he wanted to learn more about the gospel. And so he was taught, was baptized by Eli B. Kelsey, who was a wealthy man from Salt Lake City. It's strange. Kelsey later became a member of the Godbeite movement, and Charles spoke at his funeral. And then Charles also became a friend of William S. Godby, who the Godbyites were named after. And so he has he's able to keep friendships with a wide variety of individuals whose beliefs and lifestyle are different from his own. But back to his baptism. He was baptized into the church, and 4 months later was ordained a deacon. He would later declare over and over again that he just could not completely understand why he was the only member of his family to whom the gospel trumpet resonated in his ears and in his heart. He had lots of contact with his mother and his sisters. His father died before he joined the church. And he could never, although they liked him, he preached at some of their children's funerals when they died. He invited them to Mormon meetings. Even though they liked him, they never could hear the gospel trumpet. And so Charles remained the only member of his family to ever join the church. And a remarkable individual in that way. Then 2 years after he was a member of the church, he was called on his first mission. So he's only been an elder for just a little while. A brother, Timmons, ordained him an elder, and that's important to keep in mind because of an event he'll have a little later with the man that ordained him an elder. And so he leaves for his first missionary experience with an elder, Percy, who's going to another part of the mission. They were serving alone, didn't have a companion in Charles's case. And the first night, they've walked all day long. They can't get anyone to listen to them. They can't get anyone to give them food. They can't get anyone to give them a place to stay. They're traveling without Purser's script. And they sleep in a haystack. And the next morning when they get up, Elder Percy says, "This is enough for me." And he went home, abandoned his mission, and Charles never heard from him again. Now, Charles is a little different quality individual, and even though he's discouraged and he's hungry and he's cold, he makes his way to Malden. And after he had tried to get someone to help him and feed him or listen to him in Malden, I think it's around midday, and he finally gets a lady who lets him come in her house, and she gives him a drink of water. And as he sits on the couch with the drink of water, he begins to cry because this is the first person that's ever been good to him on this mission. And she happens to know somebody that has a room that, and so he is sent to, he goes to that house. The lady, he tells her his story. She consents to allow him to live in her home, and he begins his ministry in Malden. And she happens to be a relative of the Stratford family, which is a family that has there's the father and mother and 10 children. And Charles calls on them and begins to preach the gospel and baptizes the whole Stratford family. Their daughter, Lucetta, who is in her teenage years, is the most difficult of all of those, of all of the Stratfords for him to convert. And she takes longer, but she's finally baptized as well. And within a year's time, Charles Penrose has baptized 34 people, organized a branch in Malden, the first branch in that part of the British mission, and did it all by himself, with the exception of the Lord's help. And it's just a remarkable story of a missionary and his beginnings in England. Now, the reason I mentioned Lucetta Stratford is that 4 years later, Charles will marry her. At that day and time, it was okay for missionaries to marry while they're on their missions. And so in that first encounter in Malden, not only does he convert the Stratfords, but he also converts his future wife and Lucetta's brother. Edwin Stratford becomes a really good friend of Charles Penrose, and they later go into business together. And so it's fortuitous that the first day he's in this place, he's able to make friends with his family that's going to be an eternal friend of Charles, I guess we'd say.
If I may, you mentioned one passage from his diary here on March 12th, 1854. He remembered those first days in Malden and wrote in his diary, "In the morning before I arose, I laid and reflected upon the past 3 years from the time I entered Malden without a farthing or a friend but the Lord. I then came into the very house where I was laying. Then there was not a saint in the town, and in that same house I was now, as it were, surrounded by friends." So things changed over the 3 years that he worked so hard.
He did, and I just have a tremendous admiration for him as a young convert to the church and what he was able to do as a missionary. And as you well know, this first mission in England for him lasted 10 years. He was a full-time missionary for 10 years, and so he just keeps going and going and going and becomes a conference president, a very influential man in the British mission. But back in his heart, while all of this is going on, he has this, he's touched by the spirit of gathering, and he really wants to come to Utah. And he asked them, he says, every year I would ask them, and they would say, next year we will release you. And then the next year would come, and they'd say, next year we will release you. And so finally it comes to 10 years before the release actually comes. And there's some really poignant experiences that he has. When Lucetta, one night he has this very important meeting, and Lucetta is getting ready to give birth to their one of their children. I think it's the first. And there's a midwife there to help out, and Lucetta says, Charles, don't go to this meeting. And he says, I've got to go to this meeting. And he said, I just steeled myself against her importunings. And he leaves, goes to the meeting, and it's in a really bad storm and everything. And when he returns, the baby has been born, but he wasn't there. And the baby isn't going to be okay. It will die within a few days. And in fact, Lucetta, over the years, gave birth to 18 children, and only 8 of them lived. So their death was a frequent visitor at the Penrose house.
So you say he spent 10 years basically as a missionary. When did they actually immigrate to the
U.S.? In 1861 or 62, he finally gets his release. He has a bad experience after the release is given. He and Lucetta had accumulated some furniture and some other things in the 10 years previous, and Charles packs those to take with him as they come to America, and someone accused him of stealing mission a property, which after laboring there for all of those years really, really hurt his feelings. And that led him eventually to write one of his hymns, which was School Thy Feelings, Oh My Dear Brother, because he had really bad feelings towards his accusers at this period of time, and used his poetry and his music to soothe those feelings, make him react better to it. So he comes to America in the early 1860s. He crosses the plains. He's very experienced Latter-day Saint. I guess there are a few individuals in the church with more missionary service than he has at this time. And he saves a young child's life as they're crossing the plains. The young child fell out of the wagon. I can't remember if it was a he or a she was traveling in, and the wheel ran over its head. And Charles jumped out of his wagon and rushed to the individual, gave a priest a blessing, and then also took some egg white after he'd removed all of the dirt from the person's head, and smeared the egg white on it, and then bandaged it with a clear a cloth, and the person recovered and lived, and as far as I know, lived happily ever after. So he has that remarkable experience while they're crossing the plains. When they got to Utah, they moved to Farmington area, where he built a little cabin. And then shortly after their arrival, Louise Lusty, who they had known in England, who had a beautiful singing voice, and she was a friend of Lucetta, she joined them. And within 4 or 5 months, she became Charles's second wife, so he began to practice plural marriage at this time. And that's when he has his remarkable experience where they have this one of these huge eastern winds in Farmington, blows the door off of their cabin, They don't have really good windows. It looks like it's going to blow the cabin down. It was so cold in the cabin that Louise passed out from the cold, and they had to rub snow on her to revive her. And Charles has to crawl on his hands and knees to get help to nail the door back on. And it's at that point that he finally, their lives are saved. There were some deaths caused by this wind. And then when he gets back to England, has some time to reflect, which we're getting ahead of ourselves. He writes his hymn, "Blow Gently, Ye Wild Winds," based on that awful experience they'd had in that little cabin in Farmington, which still stands. People that visit Farmington, you can still go into the Charles Penrose cabin and try to imagine how he's living there with two wives and four or five children all in that small cabin.
Thank you. You're listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. Today we're discussing the life and missionary service of Charles W. Penrose with historian Kenneth Godfrey. You mentioned his poetry. We on this show like to push diary keeping for good reason. How much that we know about Charles Penrose come from his diaries?
Well, the fact that no one has published a biography about him, most of what we know about him comes from his service in the leading councils of the church and articles that appeared about him in the Improvement Era and the conference reports and the biographical information which he shares in the talks that he gave. But a good scholar would be able to put together a really good biography of Charles Penrose because he did keep his diaries. They're not as reflective of some of the really great diaries of church leaders like Wilford Woodruff or Hosea Stout, some of those that are really fine examples of good diary keeping, because he isn't reflective in them. He just writes down what happens to him without explaining how he felt because it happened, except some of those that he wrote while he's on his mission. He seemed to have more time to keep a good diary on his mission, but after he becomes a member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, he still has a diary, but the entries are much smaller and more succinct, and he'll say things like, "I met with so-and-so today," or "We had a difficulty with so-and-so today," or "B.H. Roberts and I talked on the train coming from Brigham City to Salt Lake today following the conference, and we disagreed on intelligence." And he just says something like that, which leads you to say, "Charles, tell us how you disagreed on intelligence. What was your position? What was B.H. Roberts?" You wish he would have fleshed them out a little more.
So we better get back into his narrative here. He gets to Utah, but it's not that many years before he has to go back. You mentioned that he's probably the all-time longest-serving missionary in the British Isles. So, what was the second mission like?
Well, let me just mention before we get to that is that after they had lived in Farmington for a short time, where he was ordained to 70 and became a school teacher, Ezra T. Benson, Elder Ezra T. Benson, that he'd known in England, invited him to come to Logan, where Elder Benson was serving as the apostle in residence for Cache Valley. He went to Logan, and Sherman, who was a businessman, made him a part of his store that he had built in Logan. Charles served as a clerk and a cashier, and he did some teaching, and Lucetta was able to do some teaching as well, and they seemed to be getting along all right. They'd only been in Logan about a year when he attends General Conference in 1865, and it's announced from the pulpit that he's been called on a mission to England again. And when you look at his economic situation, the number of children he has, and his two wives, it's hard to not to feel a little bit sorry for him, but maybe more sorry for them, because they've got to now take care of themselves. There were promises made that church leaders would look after him while he's away. And so in 1865, he goes back to England. And that's when we have the account that you read a few minutes ago about how he feels when he arrives back in some of those places where he had served before. But he becomes a conference president immediately, and later will serve over the London Conference, which is the largest in the mission at this period of time. And it also allows him some contacts with his sisters and with his mother. And then Franklin D. Richards, who is the president of the European Mission, calls Charles to help out with the Millennial Star as an assistant editor. So in reality, this mission changes Charles' life, changes his career, and makes him really what he, or is the start of what he really became. Now, after he served for 3 years, he goes to Franklin D. Richards and says, look, I need to be released. There are people that came over with me that are all home now, and I'm still here. And my wife and my kids, they need me. And Brother Richards says to him, so do I need you. I can't get along with the Millennial Star without you. And Charles says at this point, I became a little bit stubborn, and I told him, listen, I've got to go home. And so finally, reluctantly, Franklin D. Richards releases him. But what's ironic about the release is that Brother Richards leaves about a month before Charles leaves, and so he returns home, and Charles returns to Utah. Now, shortly after he arrives in Utah, and Franklin D. Richards founds a new newspaper in Ogden, the Ogden Junction, and asks Charles to come to Ogden and serve as the newspaper's businessman and editor. So Charles, in a sense, is rewarded for all of that by now being able to make a living. So he moves his family to Ogden and begins to manage and edit this newspaper. And he also serves on the city council. He's called to the high council. He becomes a very important man in Ogden. And then, after a few years as editor of the Ogden Junction, Brigham Young asks him to come to Salt Lake City and serve as one of the editors of the Deseret News. So, in a sense, this association on this mission where you feel sorry for him in a way when he's called because of the family situation. If that call hadn't come, his life probably would have been very much different, and he would not have become the great newspaper man that he became. Ends up in Utah's Newspaper Hall of Fame and was a great editor of several newspapers.
You mentioned that his dealings with the Millennial Star basically sent him off in this direction. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the writings he did for the Millennial Star?
Well, he writes essays on a wide variety of topics that he's interested in. There was a great interest during this period of time on evolution and Charles Darwin. So he has a number of articles written about evolution and Darwin and the church's stand on such matters. He was also interested in the Bible and how the Bible became the Bible. And there are a number of articles about the various books of the Bible. He makes an argument that none of the authors of the Bible were asked by God to write that the Bible was put together by men, and that made the Bible different from the Book of Mormon, which was a record that God had asked people to write. And he took, in some ways, an interesting view on things in the Bible. He has essays in which he says that the Book of Jonah, for example, is a really good book, even if not everything in the Book of Jonah is history. Charles had a little trouble believing that a big fish could actually swallow a man and a man could survive in a big fish. And he also had a little trouble believing that Satan and God get together in heaven and plan things out that affect Job. And so he thought there was some the poetry in the Bible and some allegories and other things, and you didn't necessarily have to take everything in the Bible literally. So he has many essays on biblical topics. And then if a minister published a pamphlet against the Latter-day Saints in England, Charles would take that minister on and show him where he was wrong. He also reacts to things that are said about the church in Utah's newspapers by anti-Mormons, and so he's a great defender of the church. But then one of his other remarkable qualities was that he was brilliant in the basics, and he could explain faith and repentance and baptism and the plan of salvation in remarkably understandable ways. And so there are also articles on the very basics of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
You talk about his stand on speculative doctrine versus scriptural doctrine, and if you don't mind, I'll read a couple of sentences here. He did not mind such ideas being taught as long as they were properly labeled. As for himself, he preferred to teach only that which could be clearly justified from the Scriptures, and his position would later be adopted by the First Presidency. So it sounds like he kind of cleared the way or blazed a trail on this type of thought.
And that's one of the reasons he has this disagreement with B.H. Roberts on intelligence, is that Brother Penrose felt that there wasn't enough scripture where you could back up some of B.H. Roberts's assertion that intelligence was individual. There were female intelligences and male intelligences, and that my intelligence was different than your intelligence, and my intelligence knew that I was different from your intelligence, and your intelligence knew that you were different from my intelligence. And so he preferred, if you just said that Joseph Smith had taught there is such a thing as intelligence that was eternal, not created, nor could it be, and leave it at that instead of trying to develop all of these things around it that were not anchored in the Scriptures. And and largely that's what the leaders of the church have said since that time, that we don't know enough about intelligence to really do a lot with it. And so maybe it's better if you start with man being a spiritual child of heavenly parents in a life before this one, where there's a little bit more scripture to back that up.
There was one other editorial entitled St. Patrick's Day Editorial, Mormonism and Scientific Thought, and that may be exactly what you're referring to. But he talks about the creation and some of the. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Right. He felt like that the creation didn't necessarily mean that the earth was created in 6 24-hour periods. He held the view that the word creation meant period of time, and we didn't know how long it was from how long the darkness was before there was light, and how long the light before there was something after that. And so in that, he thought that that the church didn't need to get too concerned about the age of the earth per se, as long as church members and our theology justified the fact that God was behind all of this. I think deep in his heart, he thought Heavenly Father could have used different methods to have created the earth, and maybe we don't know the exact method that he used. I think there's also a statement where he felt like that maybe some things were so complex that maybe we just couldn't understand it if God did tell us exactly how it happened. So he was willing to give us a little wiggle room on some things like that.
Very good. So is he finished as a missionary? Is he done?
No, he just really isn't done. He returns back to Utah and, as I said, became editor of the Deseret News. And then in 1885, because of his involvement in plural marriage, there is a warrant out for his arrest. And it's also at the same time that he and Brigham Young Jr. are asked to work with some federal officials and see if they can't persuade the Grover Cleveland administration to allow Utah to become a state. And he's also he and Brigham Young Jr. are given access to some church funds so they can pay for favorable articles to appear in the nation's newspaper about the church and its people. And so he goes back east, and he and Brigham Young Jr. are meeting with what we today would call a lobbyist. And one of the lobbyists is a man by the name of Miller, who they learn is deceiving them, and they come within a very close to giving Miller $20,000, and he guarantees that if they do, Utah will become a state. Well, they learn just before they're about to give him the money that he's a crook, and so they hold back and don't give him the money. And at this time, Penrose learns that there's a federal marshal in Washington, D.C., looking for him, going to throw him into jail. So they sneak him on board a boat, and he goes back to England. This is 1885, and serves really as the de facto editor of the Millennial Star again. That's his shortest mission. He only stays a year, and then things calm down. He's given a pardon by Grover Cleveland, and he returns back to Utah, where he continues his editorial duties. By now, he has been the editor of the Deseret News. They had filled that position while he was in England, and so he becomes the editor of the Salt Lake Herald, which was a Democratic newspaper at that period of time, but a very important one in the territory. And then he's called in the presidency of the Salt Lake Stake, which was the largest stake in the church. It was kind of served as a stake that was, in a sense, more central to the church and its meaning than some of the other stakes. I think there was one time it had 34 wards and thousands of members. And so he's serving in the stake presidency at this particular time. And then he no longer serves as the editor of the Salt Lake Herald. And so they call him as an assistant historian in the church. He works in the historian's office and does some very significant work in that office. And then one day he's he returns as editor of the Deseret News under Lorenzo Snow's administration, with the stipulation some of the Quorum of the Twelve were, when they considered him to be the editor, were a little concerned that he was too political a person. So he was admonished to keep politics out of the Deseret News. And so he's the editor of that. And one day he's in his Deseret News office. I think they've just finished a new building. And he is told that the First Presidency want to see him, which was nothing unusual. That wouldn't have surprised him. He wouldn't have thought much about that. So he went over and walked in a meeting of the First Presidency in Quorum of the Twelve. And as he opened the door to walk in, they all stood up and sang "Up Awake, Defenders of Zion," which was a song he had written. And he can't imagine why they're standing up singing one of his hymns, the First Presidency in Quorum of the Twelve. And when they had finished, Joseph F. Smith announced that he's been called to serve in the Quorum of the Twelve. Charles believed that call came because of all of the service he'd given the church those many years before and all those missions, that the Lord was rewarding him for his faith and commitment to the church. And so he became member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles that only served 2 years when he was called to go back to England and serve as the president of the European mission. So he spends another 3 years serving in that capacity, and he saw an accelerated baptismal rate. Before his arrival, Heber J. Grant, who was his successor, had distributed 2 million copies of Penrose's Rays of Living Light series and asked the missionaries to hand them out. And this seemed to have a good impact on the British people, and so the baptismal rate increased, and Charles was very successful. He got to meet with his sisters again. His mother had died by this time, and has some good warm experiences with his sisters, and went above the Arctic Circle and some of his visits to Europe, has some remarkable experiences as all those European mission presidents had, and then comes back to Utah and settles in his duties as member of the Quorum of the Twelve when Joseph F. Smith called him to be a member of the First Presidency. And so he serves in that capacity for Joseph F. Smith as well as President Heber J. Grant, eventually becoming first counselor to President Grant. And Brigham Young had once said that how did he like being a little frog in a big pool now that he'd arrived in Utah, and he kind of ends up his life becoming a fairly substantial frog in a fairly substantial position, and ends up a remarkable individual, one worth remembering.
Thank you. For most members of the church sitting in sacrament meeting, if you open your hymn book, you know, you will see Brother Penrose's name at the bottom of several hymns. As you mentioned, "Awake, Ye Defenders of Zion," a little earlier you mentioned "School Thy Feelings," which is one of the men's hymns. Also, "Beautiful Zion for Me," "God of Our Fathers, We Come Unto Thee," and probably his most famous, "O Ye Mountains High." A remarkable individual. What do you think set him apart?
Somehow when he was converted to the church, the Holy Ghost must have deeply set in his heart, because his testimony never wavers. He is absolutely convinced that the church is true. Maybe the fact that he's the only member of his family to join the church, in a sense he gave up all of that. In fact, just before he was baptized, his family offered him a position in the British government which would have assured him of a good living for the rest of his life. And he refused that, walked into the unknown, and my guess it's his testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which never seemed to falter, that allowed him to become the kind of man he was.
Good. Thank you very much. We've been talking about Charles W. Penrose today with historian Kenneth Godfrey on Legacy. Thank you very much for being here today.